Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I talk about how to use self-compassion to heal, grow, and thrive. We discuss what self-compassion is, why it's difficult to do for so many of us, why it's important to do, some techniques for practicing self-compassion, what the self is that we're trying to have compassion for, and much, much more. Folks, it's not too late to sign up for the January cohort of the Numinous course, Fundamentals of Psychedelic-Assisted Therapy. So if you're interested in getting the foundational training you need to start using psychedelic tools in your clinical practice, click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off the training. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does on the podcast. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support our show, you can do so by leaving us a review or a rating in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, please like the video, subscribe to the channel, and share it with somebody you think might benefit from the episode. Without further ado, here is today's conversation on self-compassion. Well, Reed, we are at it again, another episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, and today we're going to talk about self-compassion.
Oh, shit.
It's
Sorry.
Why'd you swear, Reed?
Delete. I didn't mean to.
I'm such an idiot. Well, I would encourage you to exercise some self-compassion, you know, with respect to your filthy mouth. We talk about it practically every episode, but I don't know that we've ever done a deep dive on self-compassion.
About time.
By itself, right? About time.
Yeah, it's a good topic. You know, it used to be, we talk about Kristen Neff as the guru of self-compassion science in the therapy world, but, and she would point this out in some of her talks too, but it used to be thought that self-criticism was at the root of depression.
Mm-hmm. Low self-esteem, right?
Yeah, but now with all this research coming out more and more on self-compassion and strategies and the role it plays in mental health conditions, it's becoming more and more clear that it's at the root of so many different mental health struggles and not just depression.
Yeah, I reflect on my own journey with self-compassion. And I think a lot of you listening could relate. I have a fairly vociferous inner critic. And he speaks loudly and clearly when I feel like I've made a mistake, feel like I've failed, feel like I haven't measured up in some way. And, he says things to me, or I say things to me that I would never say to a loved one, right? I might not even say to somebody I don't care that much about, right?
Isn't that funny?
Some of the nastiest stuff.
Think about if you were to live stream your thoughts, how that would feel like, well, what you'd think as you listened or others listened, because yeah, like as I yell out, I'm such an idiot. It's, we really say that to ourselves sometimes.
Yeah. Some of us say that to ourselves all the time. Like I've gone through periods in my life where, every second thought, you know, was some kind of critical thought. And I've talked on the show before, and sometimes I talk to my clients about the difference between clean burning motivational fuel and dirty burning motivational fuel.
Dirty.
And some people will say like, I don't want to get rid of or change my inner critical voice because it gives me my edge. It keeps me accountable, keeps me on my toes, keeps me moving forward.
Motivated. And you know, there's a little bit of truth to where that comes from in a way. I'll explain before I get us in troubled territory here, because we're talking about the need for self-compassion and the problems with self-criticism, but you can see where self-criticism comes from a mechanistic evolutionary point of view of like, it is adaptive to a certain extent to check yourself and your behavior and how you show up in the world. And like any tools that can become a trap and does for so many of us, almost universally to some degree, where it can become excessive and maladaptive. But it does stem from this place of improvement. But then there is a better way. It's not needed for motivation. There are other ways, and it's not the most sustainable thing to be beating yourself up as you go, right?
Yeah. Beating yourself up as you go. Now that's, I think, where it can get particularly malignant, when the criticism is characterological. It's not about, oh, I did that thing, I regret doing that thing. Mm-hmm. How can I not do that thing in the future?
Yeah.
It extends beyond that to, from guilt to shame, right? We've talked about the difference between guilt and shame, for example. Guilt being, oh, I kind of feel bad about a thing that I did that's out of alignment, versus yep. shame, like I am bad for doing that thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're using the I am bad self-talk, you think, to help keep you accountable, help you improve, like you said. But instead, mm-hmm. the result often is it just keeps you down, keeps you small. Yeah.
Like today, as a funny little example, I was sharing a little bit because we needed to take a moment and meditate together before we began, mm-hmm. because we like to, and also sometimes we're coming in frazzled from the default world out there and want to have a nice conversation. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. But part of it for me was I'm relearning to use a calendar, apparently, because my super awesome assistant, Claire, moved on to a new exciting position, and I've been dealing with a rather unruly inbox and everything. So I ended up at the wrong clinic for a clinic holiday lunch party today, mm-hmm. like 20-30 minutes away from where I really needed to be. When I get there and realize it, I was like, oh. So I could have said, you're such an idiot. Like, thankfully, because we do talk about this and work on this a lot, it didn't land there. It just landed in one of my favorite self-compassion strategies, just laughing at myself and the cosmic joke, the irony of it all.
Yeah.
And then take a few deep breaths and drive to the right location and try and show up with a smile still. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that you did that. I love that you handled it that way. I feel like, you know, humor as a so-called mature defense mechanism mm-hmm. Can become immature when it's really self-effacing, right? And you're harming yourself with your sarcastic, sardonic humor. But the way you just described it, it's more, like you said, just sort of giggling at the absurdity of being a human being in this world and taking oneself too seriously. In fact, during our little family time last night, we every night before the kids go to bed, we have a little check-in meeting, and sometimes we'll share a piece of wisdom or just kind of see how everybody's doing. And I asked one of my sons to share a piece of wisdom with the mm-hmm. family. And what he came up with was, don't take yourself or life too seriously.
That's wise.
I thought it was very wise. Yeah. He had just read Mark Manson's book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. So
cool.
Maybe he was inspired by that. But
yeah.
But nice. I thought it was great. You know, don't take yourself too seriously.
Proud parent moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm fond of remembering the absurdity of things. It reminds me of a line from that Ram Dass, you know, wisdom that is in the song Sit Around the Fire that we like to share. You've got to see through the absurdity of your own predicament. And we are in a human predicament here that's full of drama. Mm-hmm. And you do have to be able to, ideally, be able to laugh at it sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, so when I'm in that frame of mind, I'll try to recalibrate the thinking and be like, oh, look at you. Isn't that cute? Look at you being so hard on yourself. Look at you trying to perfect yourself so that you don't ever make a mistake again. Trying to be precious about it, you know? And sometimes it'll help. It'll help kind of take me out of that taking it too seriously, being really, really harsh.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it as we go, but one of the three components of self-compassion per Kristen Neff is that common humanity component. And in this example I shared, you know, after getting to the right location for the right holiday lunch party, you know, I did just naturally share with the people there and got to laugh at it together. And I think that's a connecting, vulnerable thing rather than trying to hide it in the closet of other shameful things that I accidentally did and never want to remember, instead of like laughing at it and learning from it.
Yeah. You know? I think the courage to share in that vulnerable way with the right group of people is almost always pays off.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does, it connects you to that common humanity of the predicament that we all share. And as much as I have had positive experiences with that, I still am often surprised when I find that somebody I've looked up to, somebody I think is like got it all figured out, shares with me that they don't, right? They don't have it all figured out.
There's a lot to be said about, sharing things, like you said, in a safe way, but when things are relatable, it doesn't quite capture the magnitude of what's happening with like sparking the common humanity within and seeing and remembering that we're all part of this larger human predicament or experience that has all sorts of suffering, all sorts of lessons learned that you might look at as failures. And it's isolating if you don't see that you're not alone in it. It can bring up hopelessness or despair even. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm also so heartwarmed to see every time I do share something like really from the heart about like, how are you doing instead of a simple good, like something from the heart, even if it's, you know, a heavy thing you got weighing on you, you know, if you're not unloading on the wrong people at the wrong time, it's amazing to see people just like really see you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or if I have a tear well up in my eye because they just got me with a question that hit something really alive in me, what I might have been terrified about sharing like years ago, I almost find so much joy in it because it creates this soul-to-soul moment of like, whoa, like they see my soul, I see their soul. We just like stop. The rest of the world melted away and we're sharing this like empathetic, you know, abiding presence together that is nourishing.
Yeah, it's real intimacy, right? And you and I have had those moments. You know, I look up to you. You're this smart, strong dude, very capable out in the world. And you've been willing to share those vulnerable sides. And the result for me, at least, is I always feel closer to you. And I always feel like
that's neat.
I can trust you more, really, because I know you're human, Reed.
Well, no, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And likewise, it is really neat to reflect on, call it out, and you know, make it more of a normal way we show up in the world. And because it does spread too.
Yeah. It's one of the things I really love about group therapy, just as an aside, because it helps. It's a laboratory where you can really experience and play around with common humanity. And one of the things that is especially, this is even researched and tested, but that is especially helpful about things like group therapy, are group cohesion and the shared empathy that comes from being human with one another and being validated and having people say, I see you and I'm there with you. And I have a relatable experience to what you're sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, on the group therapy front, you know, I did some training over the past few years in emotion focused therapy. And it's interesting in a really solid evidence-based therapy modality that is applicable and studied and can be effective in a wide range of conditions. One of the first things that's done in most emotion-focused therapy processes, individual or group, especially group, is looking at whether or not you have a predominant self-critic emotion processing style, or the other predominant one would be emotional self-interrupter, like disconnecting, numbing from. But when groups are assembled for EFT groups, it's often not looking for a common diagnosis. It's like looking for a common finding that is transdiagnostic, and that thing is self-criticism to assemble a group. And then there are all sorts of nuances and places we each are uniquely at in our personal development along that front, so we can learn from each other. But self-criticism is really amenable to sharing with one another, whether it's your therapist or especially a group.
Yeah. Maybe it would be instructive to talk about a few of the reasons people engage in self-criticism. I mean, we've alluded to a few, but I mentioned perfectionism earlier. I think, you know, if we have a belief that we need to be perfect, either generally or in some area of our life, in order to what? In order to make sure we get love and acceptance, in order to avoid rejection and judgment, in order to succeed, then it stands to reason that when we do perceive that we've made a mistake, that we're going to be pretty harsh on ourselves. So I think mm-hmm. a perfectionistic disposition or a belief related to perfectionism will often engender a pretty harsh inner critic.
Yeah. Yeah. And perfectionism is one of those things that has, like many things, most things, has a nature and nurture component. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're all born with a certain predisposition to that perfectionism. But perfectionism and what we're talking about today, like self-criticism, when things run amok, you know, can come from a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and we could list them off, but it could be fueled by, like, you know, on the surface level, there's an emotion usually under the self-criticism. And it's important to try and figure out what that is. Like, a starting point, in my opinion, of all this starts with self-awareness. You can't change what you're not aware of. Mm. But like, you could be, and like many things, it stems from our early life experiences in large part, not all of it, but you could be anything from internalizing the external excessive criticism you received as a child,
yeah.
as one example, that you think is needed because that was your world at that formative age of tens of thousands of hours that shaped you. Or maybe in a related way, you were in an environment that was so chaotic, you had to take care of everything and you needed self-criticism at that young age where it wasn't fair that you had to, but you had to keep it all together mm-hmm. and keep the house in order because, you know, your caregivers were not caregiving or whatever. Yeah.
Another version of that is like the so-called golden child phenomenon where, you know, you were the peacemaker, you were the one that didn't have problems. Mm-hmm. And so you developed this identity. It might've been an identity that was assigned to you, or you just sort of adapted by developed it. I'm stumbling over my words, mm-hmm. but you adapted it because, it was a way to keep the peace and get the love that you needed. So you developed this identity that you don't have problems.
Yeah.
And you are a delight to be around. And so it's a different take maybe on perfectionism or some of those, how those early childhood messages shape who you are, that could lead to harsh inner critic.
Yeah.
I need to stay the golden child.
Yeah. And that's kind of relatable in a certain way. Not that I'm saying I had golden child syndrome or anything like that, but I've just noticed, like, this year has been particularly a hard one for many people. I'm just seeing that more and more. And when you, like, we like triggers on this podcast, we like to talk about it, but when you get real kind of plot twists from the universe and real, like, hard stuff to deal with, that brings up a lot of things to work on that you didn't know you had or didn't have to work on before. And I think it's a similar kind of phenomenon of things are smooth sailing and then something, the rug's pulled out from under you, and then you're left with oh no, why me? Like, what if, like, you know, even though, you know, you are doing the best you can with everything you had and learning as you go, it can be this like, oh no, am I a failure? Am I bad? Those kind of things can become something to work on all of the sudden when something goes wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. You could imagine how that might pivot toward self-criticism or self-judgment.
Yeah.
I think also sometimes people will feel like to be self-compassionate is to be self-indulgent. And you can imagine this might come from a particular religious ideology or just sort of the micro ideology of a particular family or the macro ideology of a community or a culture, but
gluttony is a sin.
Yeah, yeah. One of the seven deadly sins, that you don't want to let yourself off the hook too much. It's too self-indulgent that, if you engage in too much self-compassion, then you won't, act rightly in the world. Mm-hmm. It's, a way to excuse bad behavior. And you can imagine that kind of belief fueling self-criticism.
Yeah. And a similar related one that I've seen in many clients is just when you're really afraid of rejection. So you've had some of those formative experiences in life, especially early in life, of feeling rejection, shame, and a lot of related things, bullying, trauma. Then you might have an overactive self-critic to avoid like the, because of the fear of rejection, because it feels like that will prevent it. If you're just beating everyone to the punch mm-hmm. and that dialogue is loud inside of you, mm-hmm. then, you know, you can see how that might feel protective.
Yeah. Nobody can hurt me as badly as I can hurt myself.
Yeah. Beat you to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That also is related to, I think, another thing that can lead to a harsh inner critic is simply the belief that you deserve it, right? The belief that you're bad, related to earlier when we were talking about shame.
Yeah.
That if I'm a if I am bad, then I don't deserve praise. I don't deserve compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe not necessarily a protector.
Undeserving.
Yeah.
And you know what else can lead to self-criticism? Just being alive these days and looking at social media and the standard. Yeah, yeah. Like that thief of joy. We're so in love with success that the goals that we have, I'm noticing more and more, are really unattainable. If you're looking at, like, could someone really accomplish all those on the timeline that they are setting for themselves and their ventures and their relationships and families and finances and spiritual goals, impossibly stressful. And so you will fall short. And mm-hmm. what happens then?
Yeah. That kind of comparison can be really, really insidious, and it can infect your mind in slow and subtle ways. Like if you were to ask my conscious mind, do you often compare yourself to the people you see on freaking Instagram or YouTube? I would say, no, not really. But if you expose yourself to that stuff day in and day out for hours and hours, I think it seeps in from the unconscious up.
Yeah. One kind of striking example that I've encountered time and time again, of course, because of working in the eating disorder field, is body image, which has at its root one of the big components is self-criticism. Okay. And you can see culturally where that comes from, with the unrealistic beauty ideals and mm-hmm. standards that are presented and shifting. Like, it used to be called the thin beauty ideal, but you call it the whatever it is. It's hard to even keep tabs on the Kardashian mm-hmm. beauty ideal. And, you know, in decades past, you know, Twiggy, Marilyn Monroe, etc. But yeah, that's an example of that insidious one, that we're kind of raised in this stew of, you know, excessive overvaluing of something that's like unattainable. Like, you're not born with a body type of that person you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And it would take some, you know, huge surgical innovations, leaps and bounds, and putting yourself through a hell of a lot to get anywhere near what you've internalized is what you should look like.
Yeah. You know, whenever we talk about this, it makes me frustrated by what we're up against as an innocent populace. Because there are entire industries whose entire marketing strategy is to make you feel like you're not enough, so that you'll buy the thing, invest in the thing, subscribe to the thing that they're telling you will make you feel like you're enough. I mean, arguments could be made that is what most products are trying to do in their advertising campaigns. You'll be happy if, that's why they put super sexy, happy people drinking Coca-Cola. I like Coke, but Coca-Cola, to be specific.
Yeah.
But it's I can't say that I've ever had the effusive joy and ecstasy in drinking a Coca-Cola that I see on the people in the ads. So I don't know. Sorry. Soapbox, hobby horse.
Camel cigarettes.
Yeah. Maybe I should try some of those.
I mean, if you want to look cool, like a cowboy or mm-hmm. however it's portrayed, but yeah, you're right. And, you're making me depressed. Is all lost, Steve? And is this a hopeless pursuit?
Yep.
Or should we carry on?
Definitely give up. Yep. Definitely stop trying.
I'm criticizing myself now for even trying. Just kidding.
Well, let's let's ask Dr. Kristen Neff what you ought to do here, Reed. We talked about common humanity. One of the three pillars is self-kindness. So you might think it's a synonym with self-compassion, but I like thinking about kindness because it's easy for me to think about how I might be kind to somebody else, how I might be kind to my dog. And then just flip it around. Flip that spotlight around and try to give myself some kindness and say the things to myself that I would say to a loved one if they were coming to me having made a mistake.
Yeah, I love that thought experiment and exercise to immediately shift perspective. And for me, one of the most striking examples of not being kind to self is, and I think others can relate, is like in parenting guilt. Mm. Like, say there's chaos at home and you raise your voice or more harsh than you want to be about the dishes or any little thing. That can be one big example where people might say internally after something like that, I'm such an idiot, mm-hmm. Or feel like beating themselves up. But what if someone when you're telling yourself, I'm such an idiot for any reason, what if someone who you look up to and care about and close to came up to you in that moment, gave you a giant hug and just said, it's okay, mm-hmm. Reed, you're doing the best you can. You're doing an awesome job. And like, just carry on, keep doing it. And you keep learning, and that would melt your I'm an idiot energy, right? But the thing is, we can actually give ourselves a hug like that.
Yeah. And if you might have to experiment with the right words, right? Because sometimes the self-reassurance doesn't land. You know, the inner critic is too powerful. Mm-hmm. So you're doing the best you can. I've said that to myself before, and then I can honestly say, but am I really? Like, no, I could do better.
It can become a debate.
Yeah. So I've had to find a way to end the debate. And usually it's just by zooming way out. And it's honestly that common humanity piece helps me out quite a bit. So, but I first have to start with awareness. You talked about awareness. So mindfulness is that third component from Kristen. But to just be aware that like, okay, I don't feel good about how I failed, quote unquote, at this thing that I wanted to do. It's okay that I don't feel good about it. Like I want to be accepting of those negative emotions first, at least for me. Like it is actually okay that I would like to change my behavior in the future. I would like to evolve.
I have guilt around this thing for now.
And then not allow that guilt to move into shame. Again, this is just my process, and it's a process that's helped a lot of my clients. But so it is okay that I regret what happened, regret what I did, take extreme responsibility for it. But then move from that to we all make mistakes. None of us are perfect. I don't need to be perfect. I can't be perfect. And then take committed action to repair, to grow. And if I can say to myself, I'm not going to let any good failure go to waste. I'm going to use this not as dirty fuel, but clean fuel to help me move toward my ideal self, moving toward being the action statement, right? I'm never going to get there and set up shop there. But if I can use it as a course correction, then it's easier for me to believe those reassuring self-statements when I'm being kind to myself.
Yeah, I love that. And it kind of speaks to how I see this from a big picture. Like, I think that any moment there's a part of us, you could call it if you want, the capital S self-energy, like from an IFS perspective, or the observer, but the witness consciousness, but there's a part observing oneself at any moment, more impersonally, like the opposite of that mindfulness in Kristen Neff's work is over-identification with the critic. Mm. But there is a part you can slip back into that is not over-identified, that is less judging and still observing, like with that awareness and kindness. Mm-hmm. And so that I think is... for me, the big picture way out is to slip back into the observer seat that has compassion. And like you said, you're not in that all the time. Like IFS teaches you there's a level of self energy that can be on board at any time, sometimes more than others. And in sometimes your life, it's present more of the time than other times. Right. And that's part of the practice.
Thought I had recently about that was if you're listening to this and you're struggling to know what it feels like to be an observer self or to be in core self, this is what it feels like. It feels like this.
That's interesting, Steve.
Like for me, that little vocalization represents so much. It just represents, interesting, curious. I'm not making judgments.
Curiosity.
I'm observing. Yeah. For me, that's the sound that curiosity makes is, interesting.
Yeah. I like that. The other day on my Instagram, and I haven't been sharing much lately, but I did share a quote from Alan Watts. If you want to hear it,
I guess.
About clouds, because I was on a plane and saw some pretty clouds and remembered this quote, but it's one I've shared with countless people over the years because it's been so helpful for me. And in this realm of self-compassion, but it's Alan Watts who says, "You have to regard yourself as a cloud." I probably shouldn't try it in person. It'll distract. You have to regard yourself as a cloud. Clouds never make mistakes. Did you ever see a cloud that was misshapen? Did you ever see a badly designed wave? No, they always do the right thing. And if you will treat yourself for a while as a cloud or wave, you'll realize that you can't make a mistake, whatever you do, because even if you do something that appears totally bizarre, it will all come out in the wash somehow or another. Then through this capacity, you will develop a kind of confidence. And through your confidence, you'll be able to trust your own intuition. Mm. Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. I like that he got to the trusting your own intuition part. It's not necessarily intuitive that that self-compassion might lead to trusting your own intuition, I guess.
You know, the way I think about it is if you're second-guessing before and then sheepishly making a decision because you know what's going to happen, you're going to criticize yourself like mad if things go wrong or even slightly or even if they go perfect, and because things are never really perfect, then it's kind of the opposite of that. He's speaking to the confidence of, oh, I can make a decision because it's the best one I can make at this point. And if it sucks, I tried, and it'll all come out in the wash in the end, like you said, you know, meaning, you know, life is full of these kind of learnings.
Yeah.
And it can be uncomfortable, but that's okay. And so we can entrust more and more as we go with confidence, our intuition in each moment.
Maybe related to that, one of the things that helps me trust in that way is embracing the entropy of the universe, right? And human life.
That's
another way of saying something that I guess we've already said, but as a recovering perfectionist, just acknowledging the truth that we ultimately don't have control. All of us are just trying to figure it out. Some people seem more confident than others. Some people seem more aligned with their purpose or whatever, whatever metric you're using to measure the value of a human life lived. But it has become comforting to me to embrace that, you know, it's all chaos in motion.
Yeah. It's a good reminder because it does seem like, for me anyway, it's all fine and dandy and easy when you're meditating or life is going swimmingly and you don't have as many triggers, plot twists, you know, and difficult things that come up and surprise you. But then when you get out in the real world full of chaos and failures, aka lessons and triggers, aka things that show you your work, that's when we get a chance to really practice. And that's when the stuff comes up. And that's when we get to try and really learn to open our hearts to ourselves.
So maybe some strategies and tactics. I know we sprinkle them in as we talk about these things, but before we hit record, we were talking about Tara Brach's rain meditation, and you were mentioning that you've actually used this quite a bit in your practice.
Yeah. I've taught meditation groups on and off for probably the better part of the last decade, like in yoga studios and things. And I just, when reflecting on it, when you shared that that you had stumbled across that one again, yeah, I just remember that's probably one of the more common ones I've ever dished out and became really useful in group settings, especially treatment centers. And I'm thinking because of the common experience we all share especially in these mental health struggles of self-criticism, but maybe you can share what it consists of.
Yeah. Yeah. So RAIN is an acronym that stands for recognize what's going on, allow the experience to be there just as it is, investigate with interest and care, and then nurture with self-compassion. So it's a meditation practice to help engender self-compassion. That includes a lot of the components we've talked about.
Non-identification.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, you know, present-centered mindful awareness and acceptance of what's there, which in and of itself is such a powerful tool and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And one that is, I guess, is powerful because of what I'm about to say. That's really, really hard for a lot of us to do. I know when I was first getting into mindfulness meditation back in graduate school, that was one of the harder things for me to do, was to sit with whatever was showing up, whether it was thoughts, images, yeah, sensations, feelings, and allow for it. Because usually I'm trying to control those things. I'm trying to shape it. I'm trying to, point it in a certain direction. But just allow without controlling.
Yeah.
Difficult thing to do, but incredibly beneficial.
And I think that's why it became one of the more common ones I dish out, especially in those settings, is because it gave a chance to seek some discomfort in a safe way by using a recent experience that was difficult. And like over the past few years, it's branched off into a lot of different trigger work, like things we've talked about here, mm-hmm, like the process of emotional self-exploration and et cetera. But taking something that was slightly upsetting and going there, allowing it to be there, letting it kind of be alive in you with all the feelings and visual experience of what it entailed, and then resting in that with mindful self-compassion and non-identification has been extremely useful for me. So I just kept dishing it out to others.
Yeah. One of the tools, and we actually teach this in our Fundamentals of Psychedelic Assisted Therapy training course, is embodied inquiry, or embodied inquiry.
Yeah, I love that term, by the way. Yeah. Or any inquiry term, but I love embodiment too.
I like it too, because at least for me, I've historically in my life been sort of disembodied, or had a weird relationship to my body.
Mm-hmm.
Very much in my head, very much, you know, at least try to be an intellectual, right? To be very thoughtful and solve things by thinking.
Like Mr. Duffy from, what's that, Death of a Salesman book,
yeah,
lived at a short distance from his body, like all modern men and salesmen or whatever.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, the process of really stopping, dropping into my body, getting curious about sensations, I've just learned a lot in the last several years.
Yeah.
Just learned how much there's this weird sort of bidirectional feedback loop between my body and my mind, how they're not separate things, right? We are a body mind.
Yeah, I love this topic, and I have to remind myself that it's such a tempting rabbit hole to dive in, but it's so important to this topic of, this is an embodied practice for sure. And there is emotion at the root, underneath the hood of our self-criticism, and whether it's fear of rejection or shame of, you know, X, Y, Z, or grief or whatever. You know, I think if you're really going to peel away layers and process and get to the other side of this more and more, then it does have to be embodied, because these things show up through our human bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are thoughts associated with it. But I agree with you. The mind and the body are inseparable and mutually interconnected.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I recently had an experience of trying to practice self-compassion in an embodied way. So I've been doing a particular workout routine that involves lifting heavy weight, and I've been experiencing some pain in some joints.
You're getting buff.
I'm trying to get strong. Trying to get strong again. I sort of fell off the wagon in the summer, but so going back to the lifts that I know well and enjoy, this is the way I like to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also not 21 anymore, so.
Damn it. Sort of criticizing yourself.
I've made of paper mache and rubber bands now, but so I'm experiencing pain. And the first thing that comes to my mind is, you're doing it wrong. If you were doing this right, if you're doing the things you know how to do, you wouldn't be experiencing this pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I recognized it for what it is, slowed down, And then actually did a little meditation where I went to my knees where I was feeling some pain. And it might sound a little funny, but I had some compassion for my knees. It was like, you know what? Thanks, knees, for, you know, enabling me to do some cool stuff in this world, to play sports, to ski, to climb mountains, to do all kinds of stuff. I'm sorry that you're hurting. And it's okay that my workouts aren't perfect. They're never going to be perfect. I might be in pain to one degree or another for the rest of my life. I'll make adjustments, but it's not because I'm bad. I'm doing something bad.
I'm going to cross stitch this for you for Christmas of you on your knees and like a prayer pose. Yep. And thanks, with the weight bench right next to you or something.
Yeah. Make sure
saying a prayer.
Make sure there's a lot of weight on there to make me look strong. Yeah. It was a fun embodied exercise, to play around with self-compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The other kind of big picture strategy that we were talking about early on, but is just a perspective shift. And that can be one of the simple examples would be gratitude. Like, you know, when I find myself, in a place of self-pity or why me, or like maybe I just suck at X, Y, Z or whatever. Mm-hmm. Coming back to the, like a stance of gratitude, like when you're, just that orientation towards the world is so, so powerful. But, and there are many different perspective shifts that we could talk about, but that's one simple one. Just journal about it, you know, an evidence-based tool that goes a long way.
Gratitude is powerful. I mean, and I know, like you said, it is evidence-based now. We actually can put you in a brain scanner and see how things change when you're expressing or thinking about or contemplating gratitude.
Yay, science. It's catching up.
Yeah, yeah. But gratitude is almost like a solvent. You know, whatever's in there, whether it's self-criticism, self-hatred, self-judgment, or grief, or anxiety, fear, it's hard to feel those things at their maximum, you know, amplitude while you're also feeling gratitude.
Mm-hmm. And then this next perspective shift is harder to describe, but we like to F the ineffable or attempt to anyway, but like a spiritual perspective helps so much when in the thick of a struggle, when caught up in the weeds and I'm like, oh no. What's that quote from? It's like this author named Xander, Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, who says, I'm not here to fight all the alligators. I'm here to just cross the swamp. And we can get so distracted with just fighting these never-ending little battles and forget the big picture. And, you know, that may not even apply to what I'm sharing. But the point is there is a path to our life, and when we look back on it, some of the things that we absolutely hated because they were hard or because they were unexpected, we look back and they could have been the best things that happened, or the most formative moments where we grew and learned and found the right path for us eventually, because we can't see the forest from the trees at the time, but remembering that, or just trusting the unfolding.
Yeah. I'm always really inspired when I see people doing that. You know, the person people often cite is Viktor Frankl, the author of Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah. I love his work.
Who alchemized this horrific experience in a concentration camp for insights into how to find meaning in life and to focus on what's controllable when so little is controllable. But if you want to pull on the spiritual thread, for a lot of folks, a belief in a loving, benevolent deity, you know, it can also help with self-compassion. When you're having a hard time finding compassion for self, if you have this belief that there is a God or a deity or a universal force or whatever that knows you perfectly and loves you unconditionally, that can be a really, really helpful place to go to when you're feeling really down on yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of related to that, the absurdity of our human predicament we were talking about, because if we can remember with a little gratitude, even perhaps, that life is full of waves of that stuff, like cycles of loving and grieving and wanting and having and and celebrating and letting go. It's if we can slip back into that perspective, and remember the common humanity, we're all walking each other home through this, then it becomes more manageable. It feels that way anyway. And then we start to remember that feelings come and go like clouds on a stormy day, and things march on, and there may be a silver lining or a greater unfolding at play that we're not able to see.
Yeah. Takes the pressure off, makes you feel more hopeful.
Yeah. So then, do you want to hear what, because I always do this, is what Ram Dass says on the topic?
Yeah. Let's listen to Uncle Ram.
One of these days you'll say no, but for now I'll keep
enough
doing
Ram Dass.
It. He's been banned. Yep. No, Ram Dass never gets canceled, to my knowledge. and I think it's relevant. You have to tell me. All of this cause and effect, previous incarnations, all of this is just an unfolding of a storyline, a drama. The Ram Dass story, for example, he was talking about his predicaments. There he is. How will it come out? How did it come out? Are you just sort of watching the story unfold? It has nothing to do with me because I'm not that. It's just a set of phenomena happening. Mm. When you look at yourself as a set of phenomena, what is to judge? Like those clouds. I don't even know what he's saying. I'm skipping ahead. And you begin to appreciate your uniqueness without it being better or worse. It's just different, and cultivating an appreciation of uniqueness rather than preference is a very good one. It's just that when you get inside identification with your personality, that you get into the judging mode because you're part of that awful unfolding. You're not stepping outside of it at all. The witness or the spacious awareness is outside of it. It is another contextual framework, what he sometimes calls form or formless, or being in the world but not of the world.
Human being versus human doing.
Yeah. As you are more quiet inside so that you notice and you can see your own thoughts a little more clearly, you'll see your father's voice and your mother's voice and all your education principles, voices inside your head constantly saying things to you. And you will see that what Freud calls a superego, you will see that judge is inside, and you keep giving it power by identifying with it. And you feel yourself at war with yourself, and that there is a part of you that's doing it, and there's a part of you that's judging what you're doing. And as you are quieter, you see the dynamics between the superego, the id, the ego. You see it all as just phenomena because they are phenomena. As a person, why not study it in myself as part of what, and part of what drugs did for me, he's talking about psychedelics, and then meditation did for me when he stopped using psychedelics as much. And all the spiritual things, it helps me stand back and get outside of it, to see it for what it is, as just stuff, the drama of existence, or what he would call the Leela, the divine play of existence.
Yeah, it makes me, I can't remember if we talked about this before we hit record, but like, what is the self that we were having compassion for? We're having self-compassion. And Ram Dass is always a good person to go to for a treatise on self, on sort of what it means to be here now or to be loved now.
Yeah, and I like to quote him just because, you know how like we encounter some teachers, you know, whether they're still alive or not through life, who just like kind of the puzzle piece of their message fits like a puzzle piece size void in our soul, or it resonates and vibrates at that certain frequency that our instrument is tuning to. And his words are one example of several teachers that really kind of can do that predictably for me. And Alan Watts plays a different role. You want like a funny, trippy, or witty Zen Cohen kind of perspective shift.
Yeah.
Bring it on. Like, I love that stuff too.
I just love the perspective, right? Of, what does he say? Collection of phenomenon.
Yeah.
To de-identify with these parts that you're so critical of, or to de-identify with the critic itself. And, realize what you really are, right? You are not your thoughts. You are not these beliefs. You are not this conditioned self. You are maybe not even this corporeal body, this, you know, spacesuit floating around in time and space.
Yeah. It's something that stuck with me through like early yoga training days is I remember like seeing this message from Yoga Sutras and my teachers that like, okay, so if I'm not my body, I'm not my mind, then what the heck am I? And that's a fun question. Mm-hmm. But I also saw this headline today randomly that's like, consciousness does not need a self to exist, which was interesting.
Super interesting.
Yeah. Another rabbit hole we'll avoid for now.
Well, anything else then about self-compassion that we want to leave our listeners with?
Well, no, I think one like practical tip maybe, because when we were talking about the emotion-focused therapy approach and this question of are you more prone to, or what's your predominant style, self-criticism or emotional self-interruption, I think I could share just like a little line or two on each that is really enough for many people to just see which one resonates the most. Mm. Like if you identify with this one more, it would mean that self-criticism may be more alive in you right now. Like a harsh inner critic that leaves you feeling, well, like a failure, or fill in any kind of derogatory terms, feeling incapable, fat, ugly, whatever, mm-hmm. defective, worthless. Self-criticism usually comes in the form of very negative statements. There can be anger or contempt directed towards yourself. It can lead to, like you were pointing out, shame, anxiety, hopelessness. Mm-hmm. A variation could be even self-caution when you place extremely high demands on yourself, leading you to burnout and fatigue. So that's one. And these are both alive and present in all of us. And the question that can be helpful sometimes in doing the work is what's your predominant style to know where to direct some initial energy? But the self-interruption one would be, you know, more disconnecting from your inner world, loss of contact with one's emotions, numbing out, feeling flat, not knowing what one's feeling, hard to focus inward when Steve asks you to in a meditation, in a group setting or whatever, being afraid, ashamed of emotions, dismissing them, downplaying them, stopping oneself from feeling. And so, yeah, I think along those same lines, looking at your childhood, what emotions were allowed, which ones were taboo in your home, what kind of support did you get from caregivers when you experienced like fear, sadness, anger, joy, love? Because it might be quite different for each of those. Yeah. But that's one practical way I like to, for myself and when working with others, just get to know one's inner critic, and then we can get into all sorts of fun things from there.
Yeah. Good practical tips. Well, listeners, may you be well. May you extend yourself all the compassion that it deserves.
And may all beings be happy and free and self-compassionate.
Amen.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Reed. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. Like the videos and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.